Boom. We are back, people. My name's Jack Nagle. This is another episode of Real Drug Talk. We've been away for a couple of months. Sorry to all the people that have been missing the episodes. Just had some personal stuff going on. But glad to be back with another episode and a really cool one today. Just before we jump back in, as always, if you're struggling with drugs and alcohol, addiction, addictive patterns, you want some help, you want to make some changes, but maybe you don't want to engage in the traditional rehab system, we might be able to help. We help people beat addiction and addictive patterns without having to go to rehab. So if that sounds of interest to you, check out the links in the description. That's connection-based living. Check out the links in the descriptions. We can just have a chat, see if we might be an option for you and how we can help. And if not, we can point in the right direction. So that's connection-based living. Check out the links in the description. So today's show, we got a really interesting one with like some research and a project that I've found really interesting and have been trying to help recruit for it for a little while because I think it's a really cool space. So in today's podcast, we talk about methamphetamine. This research is based around coming up with new pharmacotherapies to help people actually get off methamphetamine rather than just saying, hey, just get off it. Having that pharmacological solution there as well. The guys that we have on from Origin, Jill Betty and Alex, I apologize, Alex. I'm really bad with last names. I don't think you said it in the podcast, and I'm not even going to try and pronounce it because I'll mess it up, and I don't want to mess up your last name. But don't take it personally. I do it to everyone. But I'll put the details down in the description. But these guys are awesome. They're doing some really cool research around that pharmacotherapy drug replacement option with some really interesting drugs in ketamine and cannabinoid oil. So highly recommend that you have a listen to this podcast because it just sheds some light on some of the interesting things that are going on in the background and gives me a little bit of hope that there's still some people out there thinking differently about the solution because, if we're being honest, it doesn't seem to be working with the approaches that we have and what we're trying to do. So anyway, I'm going to stop banging on. Good to be back. Hope you enjoy the episode. Looking forward to vibing in your ears again a little more with some different shows, stories, areas of interest, all that kind of good gear. Without ado, I'll stop banging on and let's jump into the show. Peace. Sorry, my good people. Just before we jump into the show, I'm a little rusty. I was meant to mention one of the purposes behind this show is there's recruitment that's open for the clinical trial that we talk about throughout this podcast and everything that they're aiming to do with this. So I won't read out the eligibility criteria and requirements and all that stuff. It'll be in the show notes in the description and we talk about it in the podcast. But if you or someone you know that is interested in participating in the trial, please get in touch with myself or use the contact details below that'll all be there in the description. Because it's such a great thing to be a part of if you are eligible and will really help out, maybe not only yourself, but heaps of other people in the future with a successful trial and operation and all that kind of stuff. So it is interesting. It is something that I think people will be interested in as well if they're looking for help and want to make some changes and explore some different options. So check that out in the description below. And let's jump into the show with the guys from Origin. Peace, guys. Okay, boom. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Real Drug Talk. We've got another research episode today, which I was just saying to the guests that we have on, people are finding these really interesting. And I think it's because, from people that I talk to anyway, it's because people actually want to get involved and understand, how we form the services or the interventions or the medications or whatever it is that eventually go to helping people and find their way into services and stuff, how that all comes about. So we have, well, I find this topic interesting. It's one of the things that I'm really keen on. And I came across this research project, I guess, initially on a, I don't even know what you call it. See, so I'm on the thing and I don't even know what it is. No, I do, but I don't know the technical name, but I guess it's kind of like a, like an advisory review, funding review board, and then hearing the progress of this at a symposium through NCRED, which we've had the leader of that, Nadine, on previously. And yeah, just a really interesting approach and something new towards, yeah, helping people with, you know, drug replacements and things like that, and alternate ways of doing things than we probably have at the moment. But I'm going to stop banging on about it and I'm going to throw over to the guys just to introduce themselves. I'm going to let them introduce themselves because the audience knows that I mess everything up. So we got the team from Origin. So I'll throw to you guys first. So we might start with you, Alex. You just tell us who you are, a little bit about yourself and a little bit about the projects you're working on at the moment.
Yeah, well, my name's Alex. I am a research fellow and project manager at the University of Melbourne in Origin. Yeah, I've been in this field for a little while now. So I did my PhD in the same field, and then I moved to work with Jill about 3 years ago to work on some of the clinical trials that were being developed here at Origin. So my main area of interest is young people use methamphetamine, and the project I'm leading, I think it's the project you were talking about a bit earlier, but there are two little clinical trials testing new medications to help young people manage their methamphetamine use. So yeah, that's my background.
Awesome. So there's already 1,000 questions I want to ask you, but we might just jump. Can you introduce yourself quickly, Jill, and tell us about you?
Yeah, no problem. So my name is Jill Beatty and I'm a principal research fellow at Origin. I have been working in this field for quite a long time now. I started my doctoral studies in 2001. So it's, well, 22 years ago now, making me feel very old. And I started that working on ecstasy use and cognitive function at that time. And then I've done a lot of things since that time, but it's all been broadly focused around substance use related problems. And one thing, I guess, just to be really clear about is that we obviously recognize that there's a range of different experiences of substance use, and a whole bunch of people experience substances without any problems at all. And that's not what we're focused on most of the time. We kind of focus on just the difficulties, because if the people are having no problems, then they kind of don't really need psychologists meddling in their business. So I've spent about, as I said, 20 years working in this field, worked in a whole range of different areas. I'm a clinical psychologist, so I do actually do clinical work at the moment with young people at Headspace, working with young people with mental health problems, but also with a focus on mental health problems and substance use problems. And I spent 10 years in the States, where I worked primarily, and this is something you're probably going to want to ask about as well, but it's quite different from what we do here, primarily working in human lab studies, so studies that actually involve administering drugs to humans. Wow. For various reasons, focusing on MDMA and also cannabis over there, a bit of cocaine as well. And then since I came back to Australia about 6 years ago to lead the development of a research program at Origin. And so that's very youth focused. So the idea is that we are building a program that is around early intervention. And that means essentially trying to head off some of the really negative outcomes that happen for people who run into problems and keep using drugs for a long time. And then also treatments, new treatments for young people who do want help managing their drug use.
So just quickly with the, some of the audience will know, but I think it'll just help people that maybe don't understand the structures of it. Because as I said, when we do these episodes, that's the feedback that we get, is people sort of say, how do I get involved, or how do I get started in this sort of space? So you guys are both from Origin, but then are you like attached to universities as well? So Origin's like a organizer, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but organization and service, is that right? And then you guys are attached to universities as well, is that right?
Yeah, so we're actually we're part of the research arm of Origin,
Yep.
and that is actually the Centre for Youth Mental Health through the University of Melbourne.
Okay, got it.
So yeah,
Got it.
so.
Okay. Yep. So, and when you guys say research fellows, what does that mean, in the simplest terms?
Yeah, it just means that our main focus is on research. So, and the different, I guess the different levels, like it just depends on how long you've been doing it for, really, and how many. Sorry, I've got the dog barking in the
That's okay.
background.
It's okay.
How many hoops you've jumped through. So,
Yep.
if God, stupid dog. If like for me, I've been doing it for a while, so I'm essentially an associate professor. And whereas Alex is an early career researcher, which is an exciting stage of his research career to be at.
Yep.
Yeah, and so he's a research fellow.
So, can I ask Alex just quickly, like, what interests you in the field of research when it comes to, like, I'm just broadly drugs and alcohol, but substances. Yeah, like, because to be honest, I say this all the time, but a lot of people tend to kind of run the other way with some of these issues because it's so, yeah, complex and
I mean, that's exactly the reason why I'm interested in it, because it's so under research. There's so little research in alcohol and other drug in Australia, and in the world, I guess, especially in young people, which is what I'm particularly interested in. So yeah, that's why I'm running towards the problem. And yes, you're absolutely correct. It is a very complex research area, but that's what makes it very exciting and rewarding. And as you probably know, there's still a lot of stigma surrounded substance use, and that's pretty much what I'm trying to change by researching it and expanding our research program here at Origin.
It is interesting, and like, so just quickly, just off on a tangent from, yeah, like, I guess compared to Jill, like, earlier career, what, I know this is a big question straight off the bat, but yeah, like, I'm always keen about how can we attract more people in to become interested in this and sort of make it a little bit more sexy, I suppose. Like, what are some of the things you've noticed just like early on that maybe some of the challenges, but some of the exciting stuff in this space?
So look, I totally agree with you about getting more people into this field, and one of the things I really am trying to do at the moment is encourage psychologists, trainee psychologists, to consider getting trained in this kind of area, because really psychologists don't have a lot of, in general, don't have a lot of exposure to drug related training, and that's so problematic because so many of the people that they're seeing either use drugs or have experiences with or have problems with drugs, experiences or problems with drugs. And so, it's one of those things that we really need to get our workforce better equipped to assist with. And so, look, what my explanation to it, I teach in the University of Melbourne clinical psychology program, just occasional lectures. And I always say that the thing that to me is most interesting about substances and substance use is that it's both the psychological part of it, so you're still working in the psychological space, but there's also this pharmacological piece overlaid with it. And so it's really complicated. And, because like one of the things I say to people, for instance, is that, we see a lot of the time with people who have substance use or substance related problems, we see a lot of different states. So if you're a clinician working with them, people can present in lots of different ways. And you have to understand that that's related to the effects of the substance on them. Like, one day they're intoxicated, the next day they might develop withdrawal, like say for instance, opioid withdrawal can happen whilst someone's sitting in front of you. And so you've got to get your head around all this stuff. It's really complicated, it's really challenging. And because of that, we actually need the best people in the field working in this. And at the moment, that is very rarely the case. So I think that that complexity and that stigma, that complexity is something that actually should be an attraction for people, because it's like, we want the brightest people who are going to help with this issue. We want, you know, we need, it's really multidisciplinary. We need chemists, we need, you know, pharmacologists, we need psychologists, we need psychiatrists, we need everyone involved in this to cover the spectrum of the harm reduction all the way to treatment.
So I guess
I rely on that, but I do think that stigma, as Alex said, is a huge problem. And it stops people from seeking treatment, but it also stops people from going into the field as well.
It's really interesting. I'm not sure what it's like in the research space. I know everything's not about money, but a lot of it is. Like, it has to be reasonable. So, you know, yes. So I know services a little bit, and I think most people kind of do the math in their head, sort of the energy output as a worker versus the remuneration that they get back for it probably doesn't add up, you know. And I've always been of the opinion in a service space, like you're saying with psychologists and things like that, that should almost, like, the what I know that there's limited money, but the way that we, like, pay people should almost be flipped on its head, that the people doing the frontline work should get paid, you know, the majority of the money, and then maybe management kind of gets decreases. Because what, and I don't know if this happens in research, it's probably a different structure, but it kind of feels like people come into the space, they start working, but then the goal almost becomes to get out of, like, you know, the client direct work type thing, and sort of becomes more about, this is just my perception, but yeah, becomes more about, how do I become, a bureaucrat or, someone like that? Is it similar in the research space? Is it hard to generate funding? Is it hard to, get, like, a good paying wage, if there is the wage scenario, on projects and things like that? Or is it a little bit different?
Do you want to comment, Alex?
Yes. Well, I can definitely comment on funding. It is definitely one of the trickiest part of research is to actually get our projects and our studies funded. And the problem is, even when that happens, even when we do get funded, it's usually not enough money to actually run our projects properly and, like, hire new staff and get more people involved in this sphere. And I guess, Jill mentioned earlier, I am an early career researcher, which is a great time in my career, because I get to go pretty much any direction I want. But at the same time, it's really stressful because my future is so uncertain, because I have no idea if any of my ideas and projects are going to get funded and if I can continue doing what I want to do. And I guess, I mean, that I'm not sure if this is specifically related to alcohol and other drug research, but it's definitely a big problem in our field. Like, when you look up what gets funded by the government, there's so few projects in this research area.
Yeah.
And we rely on, like, smaller pools of money. Like, for example, NCRED, who funded our methamphetamine studies. It's really great initiative, but it's just not enough to attract more people.
I agree. So I just think that's interesting to touch on. And, like, I don't want to, because I know you guys are attached to organizations, so you can answer differently if it's going to get in trouble or anything. But do you think a big part of it, I know all areas are special, right? But do you think it's because it's almost like a bit of a political issue? You know, like, say if it's like cancer, right? You know, like, health ministers can kind of get on the TV and say this much, and then the community kind of gets behind it because everybody, you know, wants that to be something that's, you know, fixed and get some help in. But if you're talking about drugs and alcohol, because there's such a, as we were talking about before, stigma and community issues and different stuff that happens around it, is that largely why there's, like, not as much funding pools that come into our area, do you think?
So I reckon you're right. But I also think it's it's not just that alone. It's to do with the way the funding happens as well. So in Australia, what happens is there's, like, a big pot of money, and essentially all the researchers apply to the same. So across the whole medical sort of field. So, like, when I'm putting in a study for, like, cannabis use disorder or cannabis use problems, and that has to compete directly against, like, cancer studies.
Right.
And so what ends up happening is that if you look at the number of studies that are funded across different conditions, it doesn't actually reflect the extent to which those issues impact on the community.
Yep.
So for instance, mental health more broadly is like drastically underfunded compared to the impact that it has when we think about the actual burden of disease on the community.
Yep.
And so what we've been saying at Origin is that it should actually be funded based on the impact that it has. So the pie should be divided, not based on just what someone decides is the best research project, but there should actually be like this is the burden of this particular issue on the community. And there are ways of kind of working out what that is.
Yeah.
And then actually split it according to that. Yep. And then divide it within that according to the quality of the studies.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen at the moment. And so it's much more open to issues of like people not viewing it as an important issue.
Yep.
So like when I submit a grant, it might be reviewed by, you know, a GP or and I always say it could be reviewed by an obstetrician.
Yep.
Like it's someone who may not have any direct expertise in this area.
Yep.
And sometimes they'll like rate things that we are like, how can something get more significant than this? They'll rate it as really low on significance because they don't understand why it's important.
Yeah.
So,
And I think it's interesting, you know, because, and the reason I like talking to you guys about this stuff is because people often say to me, the system's fucked, or like, it's just, you know, why don't they do this? Why are these people not helping us with this? And when you actually explain to people the system and like how it kind of works, it helps with the understanding as to, you know, I suppose like why things are the way they are a little bit. And, you know, you guys aren't just doing irrelevant stuff. You're just kind of working in the space that you have. So just on that, the thing that I wanted to ask, so I guess, yeah, I wanted to talk to you guys a little bit about the project you're doing because I think it's interesting that I've been talking to you a little bit about that you mentioned before. But just like within all of that, so that's some of the negative, but would you guys say as well that there has been some significant shifts, even the fact that, you know, there's the openness to some of these new, well, they're not new ideas, but newer ideas with pharmacotherapy around methamphetamine, you know, these kind of new and innovative ways, if you want to call it that, and approaches, like there seems to be a bit more of an open mind to that. Would you guys agree with that? Is that kind of something that's happening at the moment?
I think so. I think, you know, and there's pros and cons of this, and we're not going to get to, I'm guessing we're not going to get into the psychedelic medicine space much, but there is a broad sort of interest in a range of different sort of approaches for treatment of mental health problems and substance related problems as well. And I think there is a recognition, you know, that we need innovate, we need to do stuff because there's like people, particularly young people, in the wake of the pandemic have just really been very distressed and quite sort of knocked off course.
Yeah.
And we need to have better approaches. We need to find new ways of addressing this. And so like at Origin, a lot of the work that we do is really based around trying to innovate around service delivery models, but also innovate around new treatments, new medication treatments, online treatments, psychiatric treatments, virtual reality treatments, like a whole bunch of different stuff. So in the space that we're in, we're really encouraged to think as broadly as possible, just to come up with stuff that works really. So,
yeah. Okay. So just quickly, maybe Alex, you can run me through it just in the 3-minute snapshot. The current like project that you guys are working on, you know, what is it? Why are you guys researching it? And, you know, sort of how it will help type thing.
Yeah, great. Well, we're currently running a couple of small clinical trials testing new medications to help young people help manage their methamphetamine use. So that's the gist. So pretty much, are we allowed to say what medication we're trialing?
Yes. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
So we're currently trialing low-dose ketamine.
Yep.
And also CBD, cannabidiol. And yes, so that's pretty much what we're doing. So we're looking for young people to join the studies and for the ketamine one to receive 2 infusions of ketamine.
Yep.
And see if it's safe and easily tolerable in this population, and also see if it actually does help them reduce the methamphetamine craving or the methamphetamine use frequency. Yep. And we're also doing the same thing with the CBD, except it's a bit different because it's daily. They take it daily rather than just twice.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing. And there's actually quite interesting evidence for ketamine to help manage stimulant use. So there's a few studies in the US showing that it's very promising to treat a cocaine use disorder. So we're hoping to pick up a good signal. And if our small studies pick up a good signal, then we'll apply for larger studies to be rolled out more broadly.
Yeah. So I don't know if you said it there. So do you call this kind of study, would it be called a pharmacotherapy if proven successful?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
So because that's kind of the follow-up question that I had, and it's really interesting. I know people will be interested in the actual drugs themselves. Because they've got a lot of press in recent times. But just like, you know, in Australia, we've had such talk around methamphetamine use, the problems that it's caused, you know, inverted commas again, everybody, the ice epidemic, you know, all this stuff, right? Why has it taken us so long to have a pharmacotherapy option for methamphetamine when we have that, you know, with opiates, you know, and there's other, you know, pharmacological treatments for other drugs and stuff like that, but with methamphetamine, not really. Why has it taken so long in this space?
I mean, it's a great question. I mean, I know they have trialed quite a few different medications, but to date, nothing has really worked. Also, I should have mentioned earlier, our goal is not to just find like a medication that's going to cure people, if that makes sense, but it's the aim is to use medication in conjunction, in combination with also psychosocial therapy.
Can I just comment on that question about the 100%. Medications? Yeah, so look, I think it's super interesting. You know, I think part of it is actually the pharmacology of the different substances and the way that they're used. So so opioids, you know, we know a lot about them. They're relatively straightforward. The impact, like on the opioid systems in the brain, the endorphin system in the brain, and the you know, we know kind of quite a lot. I mean, it's a complex system, but we know quite a lot about how it functions. And we know that in people who run into problems with heroin or other opioids, what ends up driving the problems often is withdrawal. And so it's obviously an incredibly painful thing for people to experience. And that then sort of traps them in this cycle often of just needing more of the drug, even if they don't actually particularly want it, they're kind of stuck in the cycle of needing it to just stay well.
Yeah.
And so there's been able to be developed a range of different medication approaches that will assist with this. And obviously the big one is the agonist approaches, which just gives people space to not have that sort of cycle happening, because say buprenorphine, for instance, it partially blocks the impact of opioids, but it also alleviates withdrawal. So that's a really big thing. With psychostimulants, it's quite a different mechanism, and the patterns of use are often quite different as well. So this is going to be, I know people do experience like really substantial cravings and stuff and feelings of withdrawal.
But it's different to opiates.
It's different. Completely different. Yeah. It's different. It's not such a straightforward physiological withdrawal as it is with opiates. So what's going to work in the way of opioids is not going to work necessarily in a psychostimulant situation.
Right.
And so a lot of different approaches have been taken to deal with cocaine and methamphetamine pharmacotherapies. And there's been some promising signals. I mean, one thing that's interesting is that agonist approaches, so using stimulant medications, is one of the more promising approaches to pharmacotherapy for stimulants. And one of the things that has been standing in the way of that is actually that up until recently, NIDA, which is the NIH, the drug-related arm of the NIH, which does the majority of the funding for this kind of research internationally, so where it's not done by pharma companies, if it's done by a government organisation, it's essentially mostly NIDA.
Yeah.
They didn't want to fund stimulant agonist approaches for stimulants. There was sort of a philosophical objection to it, which is kind of weird because obviously we've got over our philosophical objection to agonists for opioids. And also even nicotine. I mean, nicotine replacement therapy is essentially an agonist approach for cigarette smoking. So, so that's been one of the problems. There's been kind of political stuff going on that's made it a bit trickier. But also the pharmacology of it is just really different. And so, you know, when people, particularly cocaine, for instance, like people use in really different patterns. They use in binge patterns. So they're like using 3 or 4 days a week and then crashing for like a couple of days and then starting again. Whereas I know with meth, it's a bit more sort of frequently daily, but it's a really different matter to try and address those kinds of patterns of drug use than it is to address something which is just clearly a physiological tolerance and withdrawal. So
off the back of that, how do you guys say then look at all that and come up with ketamine and cannabinoid oil, is that right? Like how do you guys come up with those two substances and go, these are the things that we want to try? Is there some brief stuff done internationally that you pull on to see is a good idea, or how do you come to that conclusion, I suppose?
Alex?
Yeah, well, with the ketamine, as I mentioned earlier, there is a promising signal in cocaine use, which is also a stimulant. So it's very promising. And also ketamine's already approved in Australia, which is always a plus for anesthesia, and also approved in low dose for depression. And yes, Jill, sorry.
No. Okay.
And importantly, there was already a study running here at Origin testing a low dose of ketamine for youth depression. So we actually, you know, use the infrastructures already in place to run our own studies. And this is also the great thing about ketamine in this population. We know that in young people who use methamphetamine tend to have a lot of other negative outcomes, including higher in depression and anxiety. So the ketamine could just help them manage their methamphetamine use and at the same time alleviate some of those symptoms.
So what's the sort of and I don't know, maybe you guys don't have this. I could be having it wrong because I know research is essentially observation and, you know, taking what you get out of those observations. But what's the sort of idea behind the ketamine? Is it to give, I'm thinking about, and I'm sure it's not a massive dose like that, but I'm thinking back to when I took like, you know, mushrooms or something, right? And it changes, or when I took ketamine and it changes the way that you think, right? Is that essentially sort of the idea behind it, or is there some other like pharmacological impact that it's having? What's sort of the idea, or what's happening for someone when they take that to help them not to use meth in the way that they have been?
That's a great question. I'm sure Jill can comment on that a bit more, but with the ketamine, we think it has an effect directly on the some of the brain neurochemistry. And we think that the ketamine can actually facilitate learning, which then in turn can actually help with young people engaging more successfully with like psychotherapy.
Got it.
Does that make sense?
100%. So does it kind of almost like, I'm talking about it in super dumb way, sorry, but like, you know, open up essentially like another part of their brain or relax them in some way that helps them to, engage in the other parts of the, clinical stuff that they're doing.
Can I? It's super complicated. And look, this kind of stuff, there's this question, like with both ketamine and also psilocybin and MDMA, there's all these questions about what the mechanism is. Like what do we actually think is happening here that is leading to some kind of change? And it's even more important with this kind of approach than it is with normal sort of pharmacotherapy approaches, because, you know, in a normal pharmacotherapy approach, like, you know, SSRIs, for instance, antidepressants, to some extent, we don't actually need to know what they're doing because people just take them, and if they get better, then that's great, right?
Yeah.
But in the case of this sort of stuff, we're kind of pairing it with therapy, and we're thinking about it actually affecting the way that people can engage in therapy.
Yeah.
And so we do need to know, because we need to know in order to design the therapy in such a way that it will like sit at the right time, that it will be the right kind of therapy. And so the theory, and this is again a very simplified version, but what a lot of the animal research suggests is that as animals develop patterns of sort of more compulsive drug use, there are changes to a part of the brain which is called the glutamatergic system, and particularly there are changes to the frontal parts of the brain. And the idea is that this also happens in humans if they start getting like more problematic substance use.
Right.
And that is associated with having difficulties in things like decision making, new learning, like cognitive control. So controlling your inhibition, your inhibitory control, like controlling your impulses, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that stuff makes it harder for people to change patterns of behavior.
Yeah.
And that's the same with substance use or like eating chocolate. So if you've got, for whatever reason, if your inhibition is a little bit lower, it might be because you're not sleeping well. It might be because you're really upset. You're going to have more trouble controlling your behavior.
Yeah.
And so similarly, the idea is that when people develop these sort of more regular and problematic patterns of substance use, there are changes in the brain which make their control of their behavior more difficult for them.
Yeah.
And so the theory is that ketamine is normalizing these glutamatergic changes in the brain and allowing them to kind of re-engage those systems.
Yeah.
And that then allows them to have new learning.
Interesting. So we said before there's all this talk around psychedelic treatments and stuff like that, and the MDMA approval stuff and everything that's happened around that. Is this sort of in a way like a similar process with the ketamine, but with substance use issues? Is it the same?
Yeah, look, it is. And the question, there is a big question about ketamine and whether you actually need therapy, because the way it's been used in depression is actually without any kind of therapy.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a tiny little bit of data that's suggesting that if you add therapy into the piece for people with alcohol use problems, it actually has a combined effect. So there's like a bigger effect if you have both than if you just have either one.
Yeah.
So for us, even though for this small study, we're just testing the ketamine doses to make sure it's safe.
Yeah.
And when we say safe, we know it's pretty safe, right? What we want to look for is we're really looking for people starting to use ketamine after the experience, because that's one of the real risks with this particular population. Because we don't want to just introduce someone to a new
substance.
So we're just looking at that piece, and so we're not actually doing the therapy piece in this study. But if we were to go on with this, then we would combine it with therapy to try and get that sort of double whammy almost.
So what's the process that you guys undertake? That is it a set dosage and then you reduce or increase, or does it move at all for people in the study?
That's exactly right. Everyone gets the same dose in the first session, and then we ask them a bunch of questions, and then we have a study doctor assessing as well whether the dose was tolerated or not. Then in the second session, they can either go up or down a dose depending on their experience.
So like, how do I ask this? I'll just ask it. Is it a dose that would have that pharmacological impact on someone, in like alter their state, or is it so like low that they don't really experience any I guess you call it psychedelic experiences?
They're pretty low doses, but what we have found in our study is that, yes, there are some of those effects, especially in the first like half hour or hour, but it tends to go away pretty quickly after then.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Because that's the interesting thing for me when I hear all this stuff is like, you know, I remember I was talking to, again, I know they're different, I know it's different stuff, but, you know, when I was talking to Stephen Bright about on the podcast about the MDMA stuff, you know, he was saying with some of the studies that they've done that it's quite a significant sort of dose for people of MDMA that they have and then do the therapies with and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, it's like, what's that? And I guess that's exactly what you guys are doing is finding that bandwidth of, you know, how much is enough to have the impact to help people make the changes and how much is too much, you know? Yeah.
So the other thing about ketamine, I guess, is, you know, when you have a lot of ketamine, you're just going to be unconscious. It's an anesthetic, right? So when we say a low dose, we're saying it's a low dose compared to the dose that will make you unconscious. And so, I mean, I've actually been a little bit surprised because one of the things we measure, so the depression studies haven't really focused on this question of how do people feel when they're having the drug? And So what we're actually finding is that the dose that we're giving is actually it's going up quite high in terms of people's ratings of how much they feel a drug effect. So they're definitely feeling something that's certainly there. It's then it's not quite as high as what we would see on those doses of MDMA. Like when we say in a lab study, when we give MDMA to someone, we normally often see it go right up to about sort of 90, sometimes even 100. At that peak drug effect, people go really high in terms of how high they feel they are. Whereas for the couple of people that we've run so far, we got up to like 70 or 80, didn't we, Alex? Yeah,
around that 80 mark.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's still pretty high. Like they feel it. It goes down very quickly. And I guess the other thing is, you know, with MDMA, the mechanism is really squarely around the fact that the drug is doing something to the therapy. So you're having the drug on board during the therapeutic process, right? Yeah. Whereas for ketamine, it's more about you have the ketamine, it changes the brain chemistry, and then you do the therapy.
So
the drug effect itself doesn't have to go for long periods of time or anything like that. So,
Got it. Yeah. All right, so that's the ketamine. What about the cannabinoid oil? Like, what's the because that's like a different drug class essentially. So, what's the sort of theory behind that to helping people? Is it the same, but just maybe in a different way, or is it actually a little bit different overall?
Did you want me to talk about this, Alex?
Yes.
Okay. All right, cool. So cannabidiol, or I find it easier just to go CBD, is essentially a super interesting compound that has a rate, like it's very complex pharmacologically. So it's not got like a single or even a few different mechanisms. It involves a lot of different systems, and I am not a cannabinoid pharmacologist, so I'm going to not go into the different mechanisms. But it seems to have, in humans, it seems to have some really interesting effects. So first thing is it's one of the main cannabinoids that are found in cannabis. So everyone knows THC, CBD. And there's this idea that THC is the bad cannabinoid and CBD is the good cannabinoid, which is not really holding up very well. But what we do see is that at very high doses, so much higher than you would get by smoking cannabis, for instance, you see it's got it reduces anxiety.
Yep.
It reduces psychotic symptoms.
Yep.
And it seems to reduce possibly depressive symptoms as well.
Yeah.
So it seems to have these kind of therapeutic effects, but at these very high doses. So what we're getting on the shelves now in Australia, if it even is on the shelves yet, is essentially anything that's a low dose of CBD is basically placebo. Like it doesn't have any effect. So we're talking like 800, 1,000 milligrams. So very high doses. Yeah. Also deals with seizures. So
How much oil would that actually be? Is it like a glass?
It's capsule. Capsule.
Oh, it's a capsule, right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. It's just a lot more potent than than what you get in the shops.
Sorry, I just had this image of people like drinking a glass of, you know, see.
Yeah, and look, it'd be super expensive if you wanted to do it that way as well. But what we based that study on was the fact that there is a bunch of research in other drugs suggesting that that CBD might help reduce craving, might alleviate withdrawal symptoms. And this seems to be part of the broader kind of profile that it has a range of different effects. And so we based specifically the methamphetamine piece on the fact that there was some animal studies showing effects in animals. So that's like rats and stuff. So rats that are trained to self-administer methamphetamine, essentially it reduced reducing their craving in response to cues. It reduced a bunch of markers. It reduced the amount of use. So it was a bit of a promising signal in animals. And so we, even though I prefer to start with human studies as a starting point rather than animals, because often animals don't translate that well into humans. There was a bunch of, a few studies showing this kind of potentially promising effects in animals. And so that's where we based the CBD piece on. But CBD is not intoxicating, right? So it doesn't, even though it does have like a therapeutic effect, it's not going to make you high. And it's going to take, it's going to take days. Like it requires dosing every day. So people have to use it daily, essentially. And one of the cool things that, I guess one of the things that's cool about something like ketamine is that in theory, the idea is people could just have a few of these kind of sessions where it sort of ramps up the effect of therapy, and then you don't have to keep taking it forever. Whereas for CBD, it's still the sort of old kind of approach of using it every day.
But then 100%. But then in other ways and I already have had those conversations. I can see, you know, like the political conversation, I don't know, I'm just guessing, but probably helps with the CBD because they go, okay, a person's not getting high, you know, because that's when you talk to people outside of our space, that's the thing that they automatically just go to is like, oh, you can't do that. Like you're getting someone high. Like that's really, you know, and it's just that kind of conversation. So yeah, it is interesting to hear the pros and cons of both. So just quickly on that, because you mentioned before that you're in the US doing the human studies. So what you guys are doing now is like a human study, right? So what did you mean by like the was that groundbreaking at that time or a little bit different or
It's actually a whole different area, and it's hard to explain because it's not something that's commonly done in Australia. It's got a long history in the States, but like if you think about research, there's like we start our research and we do it in animals first, right? And then we have clinical trials, and typically clinical trials are like they take years, and they're in patients, they're in people who want treatment for something, right? What we were doing in the States was in the middle of those two things. And so the way that I often explain it to people is it's like, imagine animal studies, but in humans. So it's like trying to build a model of something, but in humans. And so it's like, so for instance, in we did this, we had a model of a human lab model of cannabis withdrawal. And this work actually was amongst the work that really showed that cannabis withdrawal is a thing. And so it's literally, imagine like, and people obviously volunteer for this, so it is different from rat studies, but people volunteer for it. So you bring in a bunch of people who are regular, who smoke cannabis regularly, and then they stay in a lab for a period of time. And everything is measured. Their food intake is measured, their sleep is measured, their cognition is measured, so how they're thinking, and their cannabis use is measured. And so essentially there was this whole model where on one day they get an active strain of the cannabis, and then they get 3 days of placebo, and that's the withdrawal phase, right? So we can actually quantify the withdrawal in that period of time. And then on the fourth day or fifth day, they essentially get offered cannabis again, active cannabis, but but they have to buy it out of their study earnings. And that is what we have as relapse, essentially. So it's people having to kind of spend a bunch of money on something. So it's in their interest to not do that.
Got it. Yeah.
So I'm not doing a very good job of explaining.
That explains it clearly. So that kind of in-between process that you mentioned, because this is the problem that I have with research, is that it takes so fucking long. And by the time we come up with the answers, everybody that's been experiencing goes, yeah, I fucking already knew that. And we're 10 years down the track. And, so does that approach that you did in the US in some way speed up the eventual result of whatever the question is? Yeah.
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 So what we would describe that is for instance, testing medications in that environment, people are not seeking treatment, right? So they're people who are just smoking cannabis. They're happy to smoke cannabis. They don't have any problem with it.
Yeah.
Because obviously we're not going to be taking people who want to stop using cannabis and then selling them cannabis in a lab environment, right? Also, that's not going to happen in Australia. That wouldn't fly in Australia, but it does fly in the States.
Yeah.
But we test a whole bunch of medications on these in-between models, and you can run a whole study in 6 months on that.
Yeah.
Using that model, because you're using very small groups, and you can essentially get signals for a medication. So if there's no signal, then that suggests that you probably don't want to run that into a 5-year clinical trial.
Yeah.
Whereas if you get a signal, then you can basically consider that for a bigger study.
Yeah.
And so it's a way of sort of moving that pipeline along more quickly to sort of identify the most promising candidates for the next trial.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I wish that we could have a shift in that in Australia. So, so that makes sense. So with where you guys are at now, you're recruiting for this study. So Alex, do you want to can you just talk me through the basic sort of requirements for people to kind of be a part of, what we've been talking about?
Yeah, so to be part of the study, the main criteria is to be between the age of 15 and 25. So we are targeting younger people.
Yeah.
And also they have to be currently using methamphetamine in any form. And pretty much from there, what we ask of people is to just express their interest. So there are many different ways they can do that. We have a bunch of flyers that I can send you after this. They can give me a call. They can register their interest online. They can send me an email. And then what I do is I just give them a quick phone call just to talk a bit more about the study and assess further eligibility for the study. Now, it is quite important to note, because there's small safety studies, we do have some other strict criteria to get into the study, but we do want to talk to anyone who's interested, and then I can just talk to them a bit more about what the study entails and the different criteria that make them eligible.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah.
And am I right? And I'll put all this in the show notes for anyone that's been listening to this and is kind of interested, but is there remuneration for people's time in the study as well? Is that right?
Absolutely. So we do reimburse people for every assessment, every visit they attend. Yep. So the initial visit, the first time they meet with me and we talk about the potential eligibility, they can be reimbursed $60 to $90. And if they are eligible for the study and complete the full study, they can be reimbursed up to $500. So we do value people's time. We understand they are, volunteering and taking time out of their days to help us run this study. So we do reimburse everyone.
Yeah. Thanks. So, So I'll put the details online, but what the best way, I think for everybody as well, is that if you're getting confused with it, you can reach out to us as well, and we can put you in touch. So, but I find it highly interesting what you guys are doing, because I think someone said it before, that's just my experience. What I try and go off is that it doesn't seem to be working with what we have at the moment, So it might be this, it might not be this, I don't know, but we have to, do something different, or else it's just going to keep, seemingly kind of getting worse, which is what most of the numbers keep coming back as. So I always like asking you guys this question, a bit of one without notice and a bigger question, and we can go with each of you, but if I, you know, pickpocketed Mr. Chalmers's keys and, you know, gave you the keys to the safe and the budget and all the political will, you could wave your magic wand. What would be some of the stuff that you guys would do, you know, initially to help get some change in the drug and alcohol space and make people's lives better? Now, I know that's a huge, broad question, but I just like to see what people say and what they're thinking about. So maybe we'll go the other way. We'll start with you, Jill.
Okay. The first thing that to me is really low hanging fruit is that the system that we have just is nowhere near sufficient for what the needs are. People, when people have difficulties with substance use, it is a very hard process to seek help for it.
Yeah.
And we need to make it so easy for people to access help so that the bar is just the lowest, lowest, lowest possible thing. You know, they need to be able to get it like that moment when they, so ideally, like if we had really had unlimited resources, we would be a very, very different system that was really responsive to people's needs, that was integrated with their needs for psychiatric care, for physical health, for general practice, all of those things integrated into one setting and where care was very easy and responsive to the timing of people's needs. Because at the moment we have a system where people have to climb over all these hurdles to get basic care. And that's just not appropriate. As I said, like there's, you know, for a lot of people, they waver, like they think maybe, maybe not. And we need to be able to respond in that moment when they think that when they're prepared to consider it.
Yeah. What's that stat? I don't know if you know it. I can't remember it exactly. Again, I'm shocking with details, but it's like when someone first engages in the treatment system, it takes them like, on average, is it like 5 years or something to like actually re-engage and get help or something like that?
So I don't know that particular stat, but we're actually working on a review at the moment, trying to get the figure from how long it takes people, like what is the number of how long since people first have problems until they actually get treatment, right?
Yeah.
And it's somewhere between 10 and 20 years.
Yeah.
So it's extraordinarily long period of time. And that is, I mean, this just wouldn't be tolerated in any other area of health. And so, you know, I think we need to do that. I think we need to get much better at harm reduction and destigmatizing substance use, because almost all of us use substances in one way or the other.
Yeah.
And the third thing is my special secret goal to have so contingency management is an approach to treatment for substance use where you basically pay people to change your behavior, right?
Yeah.
So I reckon we should do this for the whole of the community in Australia. Everyone should get to nominate one health-related behavior every year and then get paid to change that health-related behavior. So for one person, it might be I'm going to reduce my methamphetamine use, or I'm going to reduce, I'm not clean needles. And for another person, it might be I'm going to walk the dog more, you know, and just put them all on the same, because we could all do something to improve our health. And so they should all be on the same level, and the system should remunerate people for doing it.
Yeah, I love it. It's such a good idea. I'm interested in that too. It's really funny. I was watching an American podcast. It's about business, right? They just always just talk about business stuff. They never talk about anything else. And I'm watching it. And then randomly, I don't know, I can't even remember how it got onto that. But there's been all the talk in California. I think there's like some initiatives happening and they passed some different laws around contingency management there. Mm-hmm. And this guy that just like, he's just like a business guy. He's like, can't believe they're going to pay these people to use like drugs. And I'm just thinking, oh my God, you know, and it's really funny when you get the chance, like you just said then, to sit down and actually explain it to people. And if you just show them like the weighing up the costs of like this short-term investment to pay someone to change their behavior, and then you know, how that saves so much money in the future in the health system, because, you know, they're not engaging in whatever the harmful thing is. But anyway, that just sparked my memory when you said contingency management. Interesting. What about you, Alex? What would be your wish list?
Well, I'm a researcher, I'm not a clinician at all. So what I would do is the money is fund more research, and also get more people on board and, you know, expand our studies. Right now for the ketamine and CBD studies, we're only recruiting in and around Melbourne, you know, as far as Bendigo, Ballarat and Geelong. But it'd be great to just, you know, recruit people all over Australia. So find more research and find a way to reduce stigma as well. You know, we see ads on TV about cancer research and things like that, and I don't see why we can't have ads talking about substance use research. It's very important.
Yeah, 100%. No, I couldn't agree more. It's it is like that. That's the only frustrating thing for me. I know you got to do what you do, but just within the system that we have, it just takes so long for things to kind of come through. But it's so important, you know, to find the new and innovative stuff like what we've been talking about today, because what we're doing, just isn't working. And doesn't matter which way you cut it, that's the conclusion that everybody comes to. So just on that, how long does your study go for? Like, have you got long left running on what you guys are doing?
Keep going.
So for the ketamine study, we are recruiting until the end of this year.
Yep.
So yeah, pretty awesome. Pretty keen to see as many people as possible before then.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much for coming on, guys. As I said, everyone, the details for that will be in the show notes. But yeah, highly interesting area, and maybe we'll get you on sometime early next year when you get the different batch of results coming through, and we can get a bit of an update on how everything's going.
Cool. Sounds great. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
No worries. Thanks, guys. Have a good day. Peace, everybody. Bye.
See ya. Bye.
Okay, boom. That was another episode, everybody. Thanks for tuning in and good to be back. Again, if you or someone you know could benefit from this clinical trial, all the details will be below under the tab Origin or under the heading Origin. Really worthwhile to get involved again for you or someone that you know. And look, if you are out there listening to this and you need help to change and transform addictive patterns, but you don't want to go to rehab, as I said at the start, we run a program called Connection-Based Living, where we help people to make changes without having to go to rehab. So if that's of interest to you, please check out the links below under Connection-Based Living. And until next time, peace, everybody.